Welcome to this episode of the Uncharted 80s podcast. It's me, Martin, and I'm joined again by my good mate, Noel. How are you doing, Noel?
I'm good, mate. Thank you.
So today's episode is about the men they couldn't hang.
When your eyes behold this letter, I'll be deep within my grave. I've nothing left to give you, but for one last thing I've saved. In the corner of the cellar, look inside the iron chest, bearing seven silver medals that I scrapped the wooden dress. From the father to the son, like a bullet from a gun, seven silver crosses hammered on a wooden one. The name on the last medal is a man I never knew, though I bore his name and nature and his conscience as I grew. When they shifted back from passion, down it was raining in his head, caused not by any bullet but the faces of the dead. From the father to the son, like a bullet from a gun.
Great band.
I think we both know them. And I think it's also worth mentioning that we're interviewing a couple of members of the band, Paul Simmons and Phil Hodges from the band. Let's get into it. I'd never heard of them, right? So back in the early 80s, they sort of started in 84-ish, 1984. And then they went through to sort of early 90s, 91. And then they sort of stopped and then they restarted again in 96. I never heard of them, never seen them. I just really, really liked the name.
Yes.
So that's what attracted me to the band in the first place. And I've never heard them. And I bought their debut album, never heard their songs, never heard their music. And I just thought, I love the name of the band. And of course, in those days, records were a little bit cheaper, weren't they?
Well, they were. I mean, I've done that in the past. Like, a couple of times I've bought albums just on the strength of, yeah, the cover looks good, they look pretty cool, play it, absolute load of rubbish, straight to the charity shop. So you hit the jackpot there.
If you look at the original lineup, it was Stephan Kush on vocals and guitar, Phil Hodges on, interestingly enough, vocals, guitar, tin whistle and melodica, Paul Simmons on guitar and keyboards, John Hodges, who was the drummer and percussion, and then Shan Bradley on bass. And they sort of formed, they were sort of squatting in Shepherd's Bush and that sort of busking scene that was going on around them. And they made their debut in 84 in supporting Pogie Mahone at the...
That's the Pogues. That's their original name. Yeah. Pogie Mahone means kiss my ass. That's what the Pogues comes from. Yeah, it's Gaelic. Yeah, yeah.
They basically then got to a point where they had a first single out called The Greenfields of France. I don't know if you've heard that song.
Yeah, I mean, that's a cover of a song written by Eric Bogle, who wrote and the band played Waltzing Matilda, which is a really, really sad song about the war, you know. And it's about the Anzacs, actually, the Australian, New Zealand troops at Gallipoli in the First World War, about being basically slaughtered. And that's a really dramatic song. And similarly, the Greenfields of France is another song about the war, about the fallen soldiers of World War One. So another very poignant and great song.
Well, how do you do now, young Willie McBride? Do you mind if I sit down beside your graveside and rest for a while neath the warm summer sun? I've been walking all day and I'm nearly... Well, I see by a gravestone you was only 19 when you joined the great fallen of 1916. Well, I hope you died well and I hope you died clean. Or Willie McBride, was it slow and obscene? Did they beat the drum slowly and play the pipe lowly? Did they sound the death march as they lowered you down? Did the band sound the last post and call?
because that did get a bit of airplay on. So our old friend John Peel. So got a bit of airplay on Radio One for those listeners that don't know. But every year, John Peel used to have a what he called his Festive 50 at the back end of each year, and it was always
His
the
favorite songs of the year,
favorite songs of the year. Yeah, and that got to number three
That's
in that
great.
Festive 50, and it also became a number one in the UK indie chart.
Oh,
So
right, the independent chart, wow.
yeah. So you could see they were starting to get some publicity and some profile.
Yeah, a bit of traction, yeah.
Because they then sort of, as then into the following year, they then released their debut album, Night of a Thousand Candles, which was the one that I bought off the
Yes.
back of the
Right.
name. And of course, they then released a song called Iron Masters.
Oh, this is an old story that's rarely ever told. The raping of the country of the valley. The men who came to reap with a musket and a Bible. They wanted to take the valley. The valley. And oh, the Iron Masters, they always get their way. And so for a penance, all the people work the land, all the men and the women and the children. And on Sundays it was down to the chapel in the town. The preacher said, "Give generously. Generously, give generously, the people they gave generously." And oh, the Iron Masters, they always get their way. The Union Men is sacred on the dark side of the hill.
Yeah, that's a great song again. It's a lot of their songs are kind of, there's kind of a folk edge anyway. A lot of folk music is kind of political in its own way, you know. And this particular one was about the Industrial Revolution and about how the comparisons between that and the modern treatment of the working classes. That song was, they originally wrote it and they had to re-record it so it would be played on the radio. And when they originally wrote it, they had a swear word in there. Basically aimed at Margaret Thatcher, the Prime Minister, and they had to take it out and rewrite it so they could get some airplay on it. So yeah.
They followed it up with a song called Greenback Dollar, which, interestingly enough, wasn't on the original album.
It was produced by the mighty Nick Lowe. I mean,
It was produced by the mighty
fantastic.
Nick
It's got
Lowe.
anything he's done is always fantastic.
Their sort of second album was called How Green Is the Valley.
Oh yeah, they had the single "The Ghosts of Cable Street" on it. So Cable Street. Especially for people who are not in the UK, in 1936, in the East End of London, there was like a lot of immigrants were living there. There's a big fascist uprising, and there were men in black shirts marching through the streets. And I think the police took the side of the fascists against the locals and the other anti-fascist groups. So it turned into a battle, as the song was, the Battle of Cable Street.
England 1936. The grip of the Sabbath day. In London town, the only sound is a whisper in an alleyway. Men put on their gloves and boots, have a smoke before they go. From the west, there is a warning of a wind about to blow. Like seas are marching to the east, as his foes lay. With courage.
bit of a dark history there in the UK, actually.
Because they also released Shirt of Blue off that album.
Again, talking about the background to the songs, that's about in the UK, there was a miners' strike between 84 and 85. That, not to be underestimated, it was absolutely massive. It impacted families all across the mining areas. It literally couldn't work and had no food and everything. It was pretty grim. So that song's about that, The Shirt of Blue, yeah.
So that album and the first two albums was on Demon Records, and then in so 87 they then switched over to another record company, Magnet Records, and released which I consider to be one of their great albums, which is Waiting for Bonaparte, and that had a track on it called The Colours.
Which I love. That's a great song. Yeah, it's about an English mutineer. He was a sailor during the Napoleonic Wars.
I am a member of the Council of the Naval Mutiny. I'm no traitor to my conscience, having done my sworn duty. These are my last words before the scaffold, and I charge you all to hear. Our wretched British sailor became a citizen mutineer. Pressed into service to carry powder, I was loyal to the crack of the whip. If I starved on the streets of Bristol, I'd starve worse on a British ship. Red is the colour of the new republic. Blue is the colour. By the words of Thomas Paine, on my barren soil they fell like the sweetest drops of rain. Red is the color of the new republic. Blue is the color of the sea. White is the color of my innocence, not surrendered.
They got blacklisted by BBC Radio 1 because of a line in it, which was, "You come here to watch me hang." Because at the time there was all this stuff going on in South Africa about the townships and the oppression there, and that was kind of a poignant to something that was going on in South Africa. So the BBC couldn't play it because of that, or wouldn't play it because of that.
They write songs with a often with a meaning and with a
Yeah.
background around political events and social history and so on. And that situation where they've had to change lyrics or they've had songs banned, they had one of their later songs banned called Rosettes because of some football hooliganism
Oh, right.
connotations
Yeah,
off
yeah,
the
yeah.
back of that.
Yeah.
And actually, that was off their Silvertone album, which was sort of the following year, because they were churning out albums like year on year. I think and that is the only album, interesting enough, that made the top 40.
UK
So,
top 40. Yeah, cool.
yeah, so it got to number 38. It was still doing well in the indie charts. I got to number
Yeah.
two in the indie charts. Now, one album, Noel, that I do want to talk about is the Domino Club.
Okay.
Now, the Domino Club came after Silvertown in 1990, nearly made the chart, got to number 53, but is a has got some once again some great songs. Nine and the Unicorn is a particularly great song.
Welcome friends from overseas, I'm your guide, I aim to please. I know what you want from me, sights and smiles and history. I'll take you down to the underground, that's where the spirit of the bliss is found. Hear those sirens over your head, see that platform, that's your bed. Who went mad? Who's drowned? Who's in a cage and who's extinct? Who ended up in a uniform? The lion and the unicorn.
So I think I read about that album, if tell me if I'm wrong, they had more of a rock sound and not so much of a folk sound. So I'm guessing they had no fiddle player on that one.
It is a little bit more rocky, that is true.
Yeah.
But they did have a fiddle player, a guy called Martin Bell, who was the fiddle player from the Wonder Stuff.
Ah, the Wonder Stuff, great band. Yeah, it's interesting because fiddle players, I mean, obviously, a lot of their songs have got the fiddle on it. And is it Bobby Valentino had played
Bobby
on
Valentino's
last one?
Almost like
Yeah.
the, you know, he's not quite like the fifth Beatle, but he's definitely like the unofficial member of the band because he's been on
Yeah.
so many of their records. Of course, he's got a bit of pedigree, hasn't he?
Yeah, he, that's right. He co-wrote and played the fiddle on Young at Heart by the Bluebells.
Yeah, that's a great album, Domino Club.
I was looking through some of the gigs and stuff. They'd supported loads of people over time. The Mighty Smiths, Elvis Costello, and they've played in loads of different countries. But it's about that era that they supported David Bowie at Milton Keynes Bowl, actually, on the Sound and Vision tour.
Obviously, they did the David Bowie concert. And then the following year, they decided to split. So,
Right.
and they released a live album, Alive Alive O. And it was a good way to sort of sign off, I suppose. And then in sort of the mid 90s, 96, they decided to reform.
Cool.
But their original drummer, John Odgers, didn't join them.
He was working with Therapy, the band Therapy, wasn't he? I think.
He was working with Therapy,
yeah.
That's right. And they released an album called Never Born to Follow, which has got a song called Dennis Law and Ali McGraw on it.
Oh, wow.
And when you listen to the lyrics of it, it's literally like a homage to the 70s.
Curly word, he's Aztec bars. Was there really life on Mars? Jumping Jackie Palo, Jackson Brown. Helmet Hunters, Norman Hunter. Gary's break, Dennis Law and Ali McGraw and all of Paddy Jakes. Chippers, tomahawks and choppers and red space hoppers. Crosshopper, Pai Chang Peng. Confess you wore a rally jacket, is it all a blur? I'm gonna get a rally jacket, gonna get a girl. This time tomorrow's out of fashion. Everybody's future's in the breeze. I wanna live like all our yesterdays. In the 1970s.
They were also, at the same time, they were doing post 96, as well as the reformation of the band, they were also doing some side projects as well.
Yeah, because they kind of had that boost of about 96 time to get together, and they were doing a few things over the next few years. But then they had a kind of a bigger get together again in 2003, didn't they? When they came back with the Cherry Red Jukebox album,
and that had some great songs. And of course, now they're into the 2000s, and they weren't releasing albums as often as they were in the 80s. They then got to a stage where towards the back end of those 2000s, 2009. They released an album called Devil on the Wind. Now,
yes.
Devil on the Wind has got one of my all-time favourite songs of theirs, which actually is the title track, Devil on the Wind.
Where the fires of Hades glow. Prison Warfare.
Yeah, and it's about that. I think it's in 2009. It was 25 years since they played their first gig at the Electric Ballroom supporting the Pogues, or Poke Mahone, as you said. So, yeah, it's pretty cool to go and play there again 25 years later as a kind of 25-year celebration.
You then sort of go forward to 2014, their 30th anniversary, and they released another album called The Defiant.
And back in 2018, they released Cockahoop as well, another album, didn't they?
They did. They've just in the process of celebrating their 40th anniversary.
Wow.
And they've just released a couple of best ofs, two like double vinyls, cool. Volume 1 and Volume 2, of all of their greatest songs. Tragically, in 2021, Stefan Kush died after suffering a heart attack.
Wow, that's a shock, isn't it?
But I think, you know, the band have obviously decided to, and I know they've done this in his memory, to carry on.
But no, you know, I mean, they've had a fantastic history. I mean, looking at the, obviously, we also always talk about John Peel, of course. And obviously, they got on the Festive 50 and so on. But they also did three Peel sessions between 84 and 85. So, yeah, that was a great little boost for them at that era. And I think I was talking about gigs as well. Obviously, I mentioned they supported a few different bands, but they've toured in Europe, Canada, USA, Iceland, Egypt and Estonia. And they've played loads of festivals. Glastonbury, they played Reading, Pink Pop, Cambridge Folk. And there's a festival that I've been to a couple of times called Bearded Theory in Derbyshire. And they've played there at least twice. It's a great little festival. Yeah, very cool.
Anyway, Noel, that's the band. Let's now talk to Paul and Phil.
Perfect.
So Paul and Phil, or do I call you Swill? Is that okay to do that?
Yeah, whatever you like. I mean, even my wife calls me Swill, and my kids too sometimes. So.
Oh, right. Okay.
So where did that come from, that nickname?
It's a long time ago when I was in my early teens. I used to work in a kitchen in a village called Hamble, which is in Southampton. And one of my jobs washing the dishes and also taking out the food, which went to the pig farm. And the bins that they're put in, it's called the Swill Bins. My name's Phil. Everyone in that area had a nickname that would rhyme with your real name. And so I just got called Swill. And that was that really, really hot summer. I think it was 77, 76. So there was loads of flies around these bins and everything. It wasn't pleasant. When I moved to London, I told everyone my name was Phil. But as people came to London to visit me, as soon as they said, all right, Swill, you know, it's stuck again. So there's no point. I release records under my real name, and I go in the credits and men can hang as either my real name or have Swill in the middle or just Swill, but most people call me Swill. It's not an insult.
That's good. Just checking.
Okay. So what were your early influences? What sort of bands or records were you listening to when you were younger?
So I think we probably come from the same, you know, Paul and I met roughly when we were about 17. For me, it was listening to John Peel. The first thing I heard, the drumming on In the City from the Jam. That really, I'd never heard anything quite like that. And then I went out and I bought Anarchy in the UK as a kind of novelty. I thought it would be a laugh from what I'd read about it, thinking I'd bring it home and play it to my mates and say, oh, listen to this, you know, what like that shite. And it turned my head completely. So that, and then throw the Clash into that mix, and that would be my influences. So, Paul?
For me, when I was 13, 14, Bowie, loved Bowie. I remember watching Starman on Top of the Pops like so many people in our generation did, being completely wowed. And then went on and bought all of Bowie's albums. And then went into a massive period of loving Bob Dylan, which still happens to this very day. That's never ended. Those were my favourite artists up until pretty much similar to Swill, coming across the first wave of punk, in particular The Clash, definitely, but also The Jam and Generation X as well. And then that was what really kind of lit the fire to want to become a musician.
So your sound is very folky, I guess, or you could call it to some degree. And I love the Pogues, and I can see a kind of similarity, I guess. Were you influenced by the Pogues as well? Because they were around at the same time, weren't they?
Yeah, I think that we started off at the same time. We were busking. We got to know the Pogues through Kush, really. Although it was all really starting off at the same sort of time. I think Uptown was a little bit more at that time we were influenced because we were busking. We were doing some kind of Frankie Lane songs and stuff like that, and a few Scottish songs and whatever kind of, and some Irish songs like, you know, Whiskey in the Jar and that. We were busking in Hammersmith, so that area was mainly a kind of an Irish community and a kind of transient community. So we were busking whatever we liked and whatever gave us the most in our hat. With the Pogues, we started doing a lot of stuff together. In fact, our first gig, you know, we had a couple of members of what would become the Pogues. At that point, they were Pogue Mahone playing with us. So we had their drummer drumming with us. We had their accordion player with us too. And I think we sort of fell into that sound, although I think whether it was by, you know, intention or not, we had more of a, what we would think of as a kind of a British Celtic sound. So
Yes,
we were looking at particularly Paul with Welsh heritage, me with Scottish heritage and Irish. And, you know, that kind of came out. And we looked at songs from, if we were doing a trad song, we were looking at them from all over. I mean, Paul, you wrote a lot of lyrics. Like IMRs was obviously set in Wales because you knew.
yeah,
Yeah,
so based on stories, you know, from my family and so on. But just to briefly go back to, you know, the Pogues connection, and it certainly was a strong social connection in the sense that there was a big social scene, and we're kind of part of that. But I did always feel that there were some important differences really between us. I think we had more of a kind of affection for some of the country stuff, as Will mentioned, that we genuinely liked, that we probably first learned when we were busking 4 or 5 hours a day, not just for Frankie Lane, but you know, people like Ricky Nelson and Hank Snow and various others from that kind of mainstream country. Bit of bluegrass, bit of rockabilly as well, which we liked. And in fact, in previous bands, we'd mucked around with a bit of rockabilly as well. I don't think the Pogues had as those influences as strongly as we
No.
did. They were much more Irish. And I think that, you know, as Will said, we brought in influences from the other home nations as well.
Great stuff.
And there was a big drinking culture as well, and I think we were all a big
Yeah.
part of that. And
Yeah.
that was our
Yeah.
we could never outdrink the Pogues, but
No, that would be that way.
yeah, probably.
We did have a very good try occasionally, but
But shame won.
we were defeated.
Oh, so I wanted to ask as well. So, where did you get the name of the band from? It's a great name.
Well, there's many stories on that one. I mean, the truth probably is that, I mean, I prefer the stories to the truth. And maybe that's my ethos in life, actually. But the truth is that it was a name that the Pogues had considered to use because our friend Kush was roadieing for them at the time. He was party to those discussions about, you know, what was their name going to be. And he was particularly fond of that one. Obviously, there's the Fairport Convention song, John Babbicombe Lee, the man they couldn't hang. And there's some other mythic tales as well, which, you know, I think that in the past we've kind of liked to keep it a bit vague as to where the name came from. But you know, that's out now.
It was probably one of those drinking sessions we just can't remember.
Yeah, it's always a good answer.
And can we just say, look, you've mentioned him a couple of times, but I'm sorry, so sorry for the loss of Kush. We were both devastated as well. So, but I just wanted to say that because I'm sure he'll pop up a few times.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. He was obviously, you know, in those early days that we're currently discussing, you know, he was a very pivotal person and a great influence on both Swin and I, you know, personally as well as sort of professionally. And yeah, one of a kind.
Certainly, the name was something that the reason I bought the first album was I'd never heard your music at all. And the thing that drew me in was the name of the band. So the fact that there's a mystique around it is fascinating.
Well, it's great because the name, you know, I don't know whether we've grown into the name or what, but it seems to suit us. It suits our kind of our mythology as well as our, you know, our politics and our way of life and so on. We've had managers and record companies begging us to change our name,
Yeah.
even just call ourselves The Men, you
Oh
know,
no,
anything.
no. I
We had
know. How
agents
awful
saying
was
it's
that?
too long to go on a poster, it will always be small. We had, you know, radio stations not playing us because it was after a news item, which was going to be about the Sharpeville Six, where someone was going to be hung. You know, one record company said, change your name to the Carpet Tiles. It doesn't matter what you're called, you know. But we
Yeah.
stuck to our guns, and that's why we're
Exactly.
here now. Well
And
done.
yeah, absolutely. And really, it's like the name found us, really, because the name is very much tied up in our whole identity, you know, not just as a band, but as a group of people who are part of this whole thing, including our, you know, our fans or followers, whatever you want to call them, always becomes taking on a meaning all of its own, being you know, the man who couldn't hang. It's kind of it's an emblem, really.
Yeah, well, I think you've now got that brand, haven't you, with the logo and everything. It's just fantastic. So, you know, please don't change your name to the Carpet Tiles.
So that... But it is like that, and we're quite precious. And when you say the brand as well, we feel like, you know, not a brand like Coca-Cola, but we feel like we have got,
yeah,
you know, a brand. It's like a family. We've got a name to live up to. We don't, you know, we're very precious about things. You know, we might look like we're just having a laugh, you know, 80-90% of the time, but Paul and myself and Ricky too, now that Kush is gone, you know, this, we're like the kind of we're like the you know, in Planet of the Apes, you've got the monkeys in charge there. We're the monkeys in charge, you know.
Perfect.
So those, going back to those early days then, obviously, you know, after you met and you decided on the name, what were they like, those early days? What were those gigs like in those, you know, end of the punk era and it starting into the sort of 80s?
Well, I mean, just, they were euphoric and just crazy. Yeah. You know, it was really, really intense, you know, for a few years at the beginning. It was like a kind of eruption, really.
Paul and myself had been in a band before. In fact, most of the what became the Men That Couldn't Hang had been in a Southampton band called Catch 22. So my brother was also the drummer there, and he came into the Men That Couldn't Hang as a drummer. But we started off, you know, very quickly. You know, we were playing in the Clarendon and doing small gigs, but very quickly things exploded for us. And part of that was Phil Chevron introducing Elvis Costello to us. And Phil Chevron wasn't in the Pogues at the time. So we got signed up by Elvis Costello quite quickly. And we did a month of Sundays with Elvis Costello and the Pogues and ourselves at Hammersmith Odeon, no, Hammersmith Palais. And then things moved and suddenly we were like traveling all the time. We were doing fairly big venues in most places. I mean, for a bunch of young chaps, it was like the most exciting thing it could possibly happen to you. One minute you're living in a squat and you've got no money at all, and the next minute you're going all over the place playing to, you know, thousands of people who love you, you know, and who get you, you know. That's another thing. I think we probably thought we that would have got us before, you know, and suddenly we were amongst crowds of people who did.
Yeah. It was all extremely fast as well. I mean, it happened very fast. I mean, in the September, we'd be just living in our little cold squat down in, you know, Hetley Road or somewhere in West London, maybe busking. And then by October, we were playing at the Palais and we were on John Peel and we were in the music papers. And it was just like a whirlwind, really.
A bit like all the things that we, like, your first question was like, you know, what inspired you to start playing music and stuff. And it was a bit like all the things that we'd kind of dreamt of. It was like your tick list. You tick them off your list, you know. Like I always wanted to be on John Peel, but as soon as we're on John Peel, I thought, well, I always wanted to make a single, and we made a single. They always wanted to make an album, and you know, and then you always want, you know, then you sort of almost run out of things that were on your list. Well, you want more, you know. So yeah, it's like a dream, really, and it still is. It's amazing. Yeah. We've still got people. You know, we're on our 40th anniversary tour. People are still coming to see us. In fact, there's more people coming to see us, and we've even got a kind of, you know, we've got almost three generations in some of our audiences. We've got young people, and we've got middle people, and then we've got old people like us. You know, I remember that with our manager, you know, with our second manager, Andrew Cheeseman, who used to manage the Damned. And he really tried, and I think the record companies tried too, to get us to go and hang out in, I can't remember what they were called, but the sort of trendy clubs in town where musicians hung out. And he really would, and lots of people would. And we never did that. We never kind of, so we didn't know many famous people, if you like, and apart from maybe playing on the same, getting to know people on a festival bill, that sort of thing. But we never, ever chased people because we thought they could help us out. It was either through hard work, which didn't seem like hard work at all at the time, or it was by chance, you know, or luck.
Well, so when you got to the stage where you could do, you know, tick one of your lists, which is the single.
Yeah.
How did you get to the decision to do that first single?
The first single was Elvis Costello, really. We were in a studio in Wapping and we'd recorded the album and we'd recorded Greenfields and, and Walk and Talkin' was also on there, which was at one point was going to be the single. Because the other thing that was the buzz in where we were kind of, where we were gigging and everything was what they called at that time a cowpunk sound. But as Paul mentioned earlier, it's more of a rockabilly kind of sound. And I think that we probably thought that was going to be the single, but Elvis Costello said that if that was a single, with the kind of climate it was at that time, it could possibly be a hit single. And he said it will label you as a kind of novelty band. You'll be stuck, and you won't be able to move out of that bracket, for the ever for the 4 or 5 years that you might last, So we decided on the Greenfields of France because it was 7 minutes long. It was an anti-war song. It was a slow song. It was a waltz. And we thought, well, it might give us a little bit, establish us a little bit, but not become anything more than a little, something just slightly under the radar. But I looked at something the other day and it was, it was in the top of the indie charts for 6 months in this newspaper thing that I just read the other day. I think it was the best part of 11 months it was in the indie charts. It kind of did the opposite of what it was meant to in a way.
Do you look back and think that that was the right decision?
I don't know. Paul, what do you reckon?
Wow, I
Got a
mean,
yin and
that's
yang.
one of the classic sliding doors questions, isn't it, really? I think you have to go with what you did anyway, but it's interesting to consider that had we maybe released Walkin' Talkin' and it had have gone on to have been a proper top 10 hit, what would have happened to us? Would we have disintegrated? Would we have become just a one-hit wonder, that you wouldn't even be seeking out to talk to today? Or might we have translated that into something bigger, But that's just an alternative universe, isn't it?
Well, there's nothing I can tell you that you don't already know.
Shirt of Blue also is a great song. Yeah, that didn't chart, and I wondered if, do you think it would now? Because there's a lot more folkier sort of stuff in the charts now.
I don't know. Maybe Church of Blues, a song specifically about the miners' strike. We don't think we put it out as a single, not in any way expecting it to be a hit. I don't think, as I remember back, I think it was proud that it had come out as a single. I don't know what MCA Records thought. Probably didn't really understand what to do. To us, it was an obvious single because it was a strong, one of the strongest songs we had at that time. And it told a story we wanted to tell and that we identified with. And it was much more about us building our identity, I think, with that rather than looking for, hits.
Funny enough, with that exact song, I was in Switzerland last week and I did a gig at the end of the week. And when I was putting the set list together, I had Shirt of Blue on there. And someone said, "Oh, you don't do Shirt of Blue. The Swiss people, it's got no connection with Switzerland and the Swiss people won't relate to it or really get it. And it's of a certain time and a certain place." But anyway, I did it anyway. And it went down fantastically well. And I think that people, it's a bit like Ghost of Cable Street would be another one like that Paul wrote. I think that people get it because they get the passion in the song. And even if, we had songs like The Colours, that set hundreds of years in the past that maybe not, I suppose my point is, I think that it's the underlying passion in the songwriting and the performance of the songs that has kind of propelled the band, you know.
I'd like to just say that whilst obviously Shirt of Blue on the surface, and also, fairly deep down is a story of two protagonists in the miners' strike, I always used to say to people that it's just as much a story about two kids and friends growing up who end up on different sides, and that can translate, right across the board in any society, really, and that, so it's a common factor. And in fact, I think I have said this before, but not very often. The song that I kind of used as a sort of reference point when I was writing Shirt of Blue was Rolf Harris's Two Little Boys, which, probably shouldn't really admit, I guess, these days. But at the time, it was, as you remember, it was a story about two kids on either side of the American Civil War.
Yeah.
It's ironic, Paul, because if that is you're kind of you're a little bit of a seed of the influence of that song. The song that you mentioned was Margaret Thatcher's favorite song, and
Was
Shirt
it?
of Blue is kind of the antithesis of
Well, I
Thatcherism.
like that. That's a really good thing. I think that's a good. I like that coincidence. That sounds great to me. But so really, at the heart of it is a story about two kids growing up and what happens to them and how they manage to maintain some kind of relationship despite their lives going in such opposite ways, and destiny or fate or something has got this thing in store for them where they have to kind of meet again in this crucible, or where their choices or what's happened to them come out into like full relief in the sort of in the dramatic conclusion.
Tell me, have you got a new shirt? Is its color a fine bright blue? Has your mother sent you off to your school from the street with a pretty view? Shall we wrestle in the old schoolyard like the other children do? You can scuff your shoes, you can tear your hands, and they'll rip that shirt off you. Hey now, Tommy, since you moved away, they've taken our town and they made it new. Now there stands a chemical plant where the cherry orchards grew. And I married Lucy from the back of our class, who once wrote letters to you. We've got kids and we sent them to school from the street with a pretty view. Oh, in your shirt of blue. Oh, in your shirt of blue. Where the flowers grow, from a butterfly stick to a ballad and a brick, changing uniforms far too soon. Hey now, Tommy, shall we meet again in the morning wet with you? Me at the gates of the collier.
Okay, so you get to your first single, and then you go into with Demon Records, you get your first album. What was that period like to leading up to that first album?
It was we couldn't believe it was all happening. I think we were thinking, when's it going to stop? When are we going to be found out? that we're imposters of some sort.
I still wonder that to this day.
But I think that, yeah, like I say, we were sort of living out our dreams. Everything was great. I mean, I think we were very lucky with Demon because they were, you know, a nurturing company. They were understanding. They wanted us to be ourselves. Some of the future companies weren't quite so nurturing and understanding. I think it would have been different if we'd been signed to MCA or someone like that straight away. But yeah, and we made a lot of good friends. It enabled us to go and make that first album within a budget that, you know, it wasn't like a kind of Bad News, if you know Bad News, which was like the British equivalent of Spinal Tap from the comic strip, you know, to make it sound good without overloading it and, you know, cut our teeth, if you like.
I think it was £12,000 was the whole budget for Night of a Thousand Candles, that inclusive of everything, you know, including the promo, the recording, and some very sort of paltry kind of allowances for us. But it was an absolute fortune to us at that point, don't forget, because, you know, we'd had absolutely nothing before that. And to have, you know, the ability to go into a studio day after day, maybe take a little more time than we were used to get things right, not as much as we ended up taking when we went to some of the mega labels later on. But it was fascinating, and it's kind of, we learned an awful lot, I think, you know, making that record. We learned a lot.
I'm glad you mentioned record labels, because you seem to have had a lot over the years. Why do you think that is?
Because they don't seem to know. They didn't seem to know how to make a buck out of us, really. I think that they were like, how do we make money out of them? And they couldn't hang, you know, and they'd have a go and they'd fail. And then they go, oh, no, pass them on. And so somebody else would have a go. But we never had any shortage of people, you know, wanting to take us on. It's just that they wouldn't stay the course, you know.
And you asked earlier about, you know, that first single was, you know, what if we'd done something else, or, you know, was it the right choice? I mean, looking back, I think we were probably, you know, we were enticed to leave Demon. We might have been better staying with Demon, but, you know, we were young and they were very, you know, encouraging in many different ways, the sort of major labels. And as Paul said, you know, we didn't stay on, I don't think we stayed on one for more than one album, each of them, you know, but there never seemed to be any trouble. We eventually went back to Silvertone, which is part of Demon, for a while. And then I think we just now, I mean, the truth is, and I bet just about any of the bands that you talk to would say this, you don't need a label anymore. As long as you've got, you know, a foundation in music, we're our own label now, and we see more, you know, return on it than we did on any of the albums we made on majors, because none of them, it would be impossible for them to break even, because the little tiny 4% or something that you get from a record company has got to pay for everything. While they're kind of schmoozing on their 96%, you know, it's virtually impossible to pay a label back. So we don't see a penny in royalties from any of the larger labels that we were on.
I mean, it's quite amusing to me, because sometimes you get a view of, you know, the balance sheet that you have with somebody like, let's say, Warner Brothers, with whom we did, you know, Waiting for Bonaparte and what have you. And we are so much in debt with it. It's unbelievable. I mean, we still owe them over £100,000 or something like that. It's quite incredible, you know. I will never pay it back, obviously. And it's absurd. And but really, and although, you know, we would have been better staying with Demon, of course, or with a similar label, you know. You know, we did enjoy, well, I certainly did, going to, you know, studios like The Manor and other studios, like the Townhouse and stuff, and getting to do that experience of making one of those kind of big 80s records, you know, which I'm really pleased we did and I'm proud of. But, oh, God, you know, we were, we were a kiss of death to major labels. You know, they took a big bath on us, really. But, hey-ho, they made it back on somebody else. Do you know what I mean?
Every time we speak to one of the bands and they've had a record label interference, in inverted commas, that, you know, they've either tried to change their style, their sound, or push them into a completely different direction. And you know, it's despair at the
I
because
mean, Swill, you remember this, I'm certain. Of course, I'm going to tell a little story about being summoned to Warner Brothers in Kensington High Street after being on their label for a while. And well, first of all, when we got there, we went up to the reception and said, "Oh, it's the American Hang. We've got a meeting with X." And the lady pulled out this huge, great book. And I had to thumb through all the N's and the M's until she came to our name. And, "Oh, American, are you here?" We went up to have the meeting with this guy whose name I can't remember, honestly. And he said, "Right, I'm going to name three songs that I want you to consider for your next single. You have to choose one of them." And he named a song by a band called Big Trigger, I think they were called The
It's the band
Colours.
that did that song River,
Yeah,
flow down
that
the river by
band.
Dug Echo, yeah.
There were two others to this day I can't really remember that we didn't like any of them and said so, you know. And he said, "Well, the thing is, I'm going to give you a week. And if I don't hear from you that you're going to choose one of these songs to do a cover of, I'll assume that you've left the label." And
Wow.
so we left that meeting and immediately said to each other, even on the pavement, before we'd even got to the pub next door, "That's it. That's over, because we're not going to do one of those three songs. For sure, we're not going to." He said, "I guarantee we will chart it. We have the muscle at Warner Brothers. We'll get that track into the top 20. And, you know, but you just have to play ball." And we took great pleasure in saying no way. You know, I mean, in those days, perhaps we were kind of, I don't know, but it seemed fun to say no to the label and to know that we would be leaving what was the biggest record label in the world at the time. It felt validating, and I felt, "Oh, we're back. We're really the men that can hang again, because we've said no to this label, you know, and that's it for us. We'll be off that label in a week's time." And we were.
But you kept
We'd have
your
been much
integrity.
more upset by being banned from our local pub.
We
Sorry,
took it in
Noel.
our stride. It was like, it was as if it was, "Oh, well, we've just left Warner Brothers. Fine, you know, what's next? You know, what should we do now?" And I mean, I thought it was, I still do think it was quite funny, you know, because this guy, who's one of your classic 80s A&R guy, I wish I could remember his name, I'd happily say it. But when we went into his office, he had Whale Song playing on some kind of piped, you know, and he had the classic, you know, the baseball bat by the side of his desk, you know, some kind of hangover from Led Zeppelin or something like that. I mean, this guy wouldn't last 10 seconds, you know, in our local pub, by the way, you know, baseball bat or not. And so that I just think that was a very good example of the men that couldn't hang, sticking to our guns and being helping us grow into our identity, the fact that we said no.
Great stuff, yeah.
How bothered were you about that lack of chart success? Was it something that was important to you or not? It was probably more important to the labels, I get that, but what about you as a band?
I would have loved it, you know. I would have liked to have had more chart success personally. I think that chart success is validating. It means you get to more people. It as you extend your career, perhaps have more resources. It's good for the ego. And at one time, I very much would have liked to have had more chart success, because I mean, you know, if you look at the singles that we put out over the course of that 5 or 6 years, up until 1990, maybe, plenty of them were fairly squarely aimed at trying to get a hit on the radio, like A Place in the Sun, you know, and a couple of the others. It just didn't work out, you know, and we've actually had more success with the songs that were not intended to do that, you know.
Rosettes was a big miss, you know, it was a big shame, wasn't it?
Which one?
Rosettes.
Oh, well, that was circumstances, wasn't it? You know, we had bad luck once again, as we did with The Colours, which was on the Radio 1 A-list until an incident in apartheid South Africa, which led to, you know, a mass arrest, was conflated with our name, and ruling came down, take them and they can hang off the playlist. That's a political name now, and we can't risk it. And then, of course, with Rosettes, we had Hillsborough. I remember we were all sat in the pub talking, looking at the artwork of the single for Rosettes when Hillsborough was on the television in the pub, and before the end of that meeting, oh, it's not going to come out, is it?
The boat across, we were 48, two in the magistrate's court. Two didn't get past the customs man, three got drunk in a hold. Four got homesick straight away, one pair of feet got cold. Raising the flag, while without regrets, waving scarves, singing hard.
I think that, I mean, I felt, you know, as Paul said as well, I still do to some degree, like a fake, or, you know, what's it called?
Imposter syndrome.
Imposter syndrome. But I think I'd got to the point where, you know, I'd love to have seen a single in the charts, and probably more for any other reason than to for my mum and dad to sort of just for me to justify to them why I'd taken this sort of this route, and for them to be able to tell their friends. But I kind of felt it would never happen. But what I took more notice of was the reviews, gig reviews, all record reviews, and they were kind of much more disappointing. If you got, sometimes you get a bad review where you just knew. Sometimes you knew the person hadn't been there if it was a gig. Sometimes you got a bad review when you just knew someone just wanted to give you a bad review. But we could tell that for one way or the other. Sometimes we'd even get the nod, but a regular reader wouldn't get that, so they just take it as read. You know, the music press now is you know, nothing compared, it has no power anymore, but in those days it was all powerful. And I must say, we had a lot of good help from, you know, the Enemy and the Melody Maker in particular, but Sounds too in those days. But then it came a time maybe when some newer journalists came in, or the ones that had written about us had just written about us too many times and it had always been good editorial control. So they said, right, well, let's put some, you know, some new person in there. And there's, you know, there's other music coming along. The incredible thing is that we're still doing it and we're still here. And Kush would be here as well if it hadn't been for, you know, the way the world turned. But, you know, some of these people who made scathing, nasty reviews of our craft, well, they're not working in their craft anymore, you know.
No.
So that lead up then to that first iteration in the sort of split in the mid-90s then, what was the lead up to that? I don't want to be painful and go through
well, no, it's not cool. I mean, it was just exhaustion, you know, physical and mental. We did 5 albums in 5 years. And from 1986 onwards, we were constantly on the road as well, yeah, which was fun, but sometimes you can have too much fun, you know. And we were just very, very exhausted by 1990, I think. And also, the final album of that period, The Domino Club, had probably, as Will commented, the worst reviews of our entire career, you know. I mean, it was across the board. Ironically enough, that album has now been, you know, reconsidered, and many of our fans have it as their favourite album of ours. You know,
I love it.
At the time, it was just roundly condemned. And also, you know, when we were recording that album, we were in a studio with the Stone Roses in the studio next door recording their album. And I guess, you know, it felt a little bit like the changing of the guard, and a new generation was coming in to do something different, and we were old hat. And that feeling, really, I suppose, combined with the bad reviews to sort of bring about a sense of kind of ennui, feeling of well, we've had a good run, maybe we should leave it there.
With that intensive travelling, even though the amazing thing about the Mendicant Hang has always been that we're all pals, you know, we're all friends. We weren't thrown together through skills, that's for sure. We were thrown together because we all knew each other and we'd introduce friends into that circle. But, you know, travelling through, you know, all across Germany, you know, all of Europe in the back of a sleeper bus, 24 hours a day, sometimes 7 days a week, maybe if you're lucky you might get a duff here and there, but it will test your friendship to the nth degree. You'll have heard every single joke that anyone's ever had, and you know you need to get a break from each other, and or it will break the band. It breaks a lot of bands, and I think that some of us, neither not me or Paul, but some of us felt that maybe that was it. The weird thing was we would still be going to this famous pub together after just a few days apart, and sort of saying, and we couldn't go to a gig together. That'd be the worst thing, going to watch someone on stage.
Yeah,
thinking, well, we should be up there, you know. So, and at that time, that was a mistake, but it couldn't be any other way, because we'd have just, you know, had a breakdown, I think.
Yeah, and possibly, you know, we did used to, you know, tour very intensely, to use a kind of metaphor, and maybe not all of us would have made it out. You know, I think it was hardcore.
Yeah.
So I mean, obviously, fast forward a bit from there, you obviously must have got the energy and the focus back again for the reunion. You must have. I guess it sounds like you didn't lose the passion, but it was more the it just kind of wore you down a bit. But how did you get back to a stage of, you know, reuniting and starting again?
I mean, very good money was offered. You know, that's partly it. And we started to do a series of reunion shows that were very well attended. There was still, obviously, the audience hadn't gone away at all. And, you know, we grew up a little bit, got our personal lives a little bit more together in most cases. And we figured, you know, maybe there's more. And looks like there was 25 years more.
Yes.
But in some ways, we'd never really stopped, because we stopped for that while. But Paul and I carried on.
We had a band.
We had a band called Liberty Cage, which, you know, so we continued to gig, a tour and record. Other members of the band did other things. And we got back together, you know, reasonably quickly, really. So it's not like the Men have just reformed for our 40th anniversary. We've been gigging for years. But what we hadn't done is toured so extensively as we are now, for one reason or another. You know, we're mainly gigging. At a push, we'll do Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. So it's not like that'd be the most we would do in a week. It's not like that we would do in the old days. We couldn't do that. We don't drink so much. We don't go to bed so late. Well, at least we go to bed. But, you know, it's just that this tour is taking us to places that we haven't been before. And this is just still within the UK, you know, because Brexit came along as well, of course, and made it very difficult for UK bands to get out of the UK, you know, and play.
Let's just talk a little bit about songwriting, if we may. I just wondered how that's changed, if at all, over the years.
Not really. Don't think it's changed that much. Seemingly the same process, although, you know, we haven't really done much since Kush passed away, since Cock a Hoop.
I think the thing that has changed is the ability to make reasonably decent recordings at home. So instead of going into a rehearsal studio with the band and saying, here's my idea of a song, you can actually send them in advance and say, this is a song I'm working on, have a listen, and when we get together, we'll all, you know, put our own ideas and do that. But yeah, as Paul says, you know, our way of writing, you know, which is one person, mainly Paul, brings a song to the band and then we all work on that and then we all put in our little bits. That way of working is still the same. We still use sort of topical themes and, you know, historical references too. And I think even though I don't know where it can finish, but we still write from the heart as well. There's a lot of songs that people won't ever hear because we're far worse critics on ourselves than anyone else could ever possibly be. It's quite hard sometimes. We are quite ruthless with each other, but we can take it. You know, we've known each other for so long.
It also means that, you know, only the best stuff comes to the fore, which is, you know, that's probably a good filtering system, really, to have that, you know.
And are you constantly writing, or do you do it in blocks or not?
Personally, I used to be constantly writing. Now it's much much less, but much more rare, I would say.
Yeah, I get for myself, I get moments of clarity. I get moments where I think, ah, there's a song, and I'll work on something over a longer period of time. Also, I think we subconsciously at least try not to repeat ourselves. There's no point in writing. Although there are sequels, Paul has written, there's
Yeah,
a
the sequels are good. They're
trilogy of stuff and so on.
good fun to do that. Yeah, we did going back to Coventry, which was followed by A Place in the Sun involving the same two characters, and then there was a third one, which was Great Expectations. That was the main one.
Also, I suppose as well that Paul mentioned Kush dying in 21, and Paul wrote a song called Red Kite or Red Kite Rising.
Sounded and the clouds looked down. Birds in the hills were flipping and singing. Something's coming, something's coming. We're not gonna sleep tonight. So here comes seven out of Langeth, stretching in the wind like a willow tree. Brushing off the ashes, looking at the fashions. I never stayed down the towny ground. Are you coming downtown with me? You're out of time. Look on the blue horizon, and you see the red kite rising.
Which is based on our experiences, and the feeling at Kush's funeral, because it was during lockdown, or lockdown was just loosening up a little, so seven of us could go from England to Wales, and of course there was family members there and so on. I think we'd like to have 20 or 30 altogether, but from out of town, seven of us, and there was lots of it was a very obviously emotional experience, but there was spiritual too, and we thought about things very deeply, and so a song came out of that. But I suppose my point is as well is that at that time, and from that time for a couple of years, it was hard not to write a song that wasn't about Kush. We had to, we could rewrite a whole album easily. We could write a whole album about that. But we have to, keep a balance as well as, putting our emotions down on paper and down on vinyl or tape or digital or whatever it is,
I try to get myself these days when doing songwriting, I try to think about the life experiences of the people who come to see us as well, rather than just me. I've only rarely written about me. Occasionally I have, but mostly I try to put myself in somebody else's shoes to try to find areas that I know that the people who are our natural constituency will also feel emotive about, and so that's why it takes longer now, because there's more to consider, and it's deeper.
How difficult was the decision to keep going with the band?
After Kush? That was a tough one, and I suppose to set the context, when we first got the call, we'd had a Zoom meeting with Kush just 3 days before he died. It was the first time Kush had ever done a Zoom meeting, and he only got in at the very end of it, and it was complete chaos. But it was like a big laughing party. We were just all laughing, and it was like we were all together, and we had all these plans we made, and for once we all agreed as well. We were going to do an acoustic album, we were going to go out and tour, we were going to do a Mendicant at Bourke, and we all it was really, really great. And then 3 days later, we got the call. Paul got a call first, and he called me, and then I had to call some other people in the band. And the way it hit you, it's like you just could not believe that it was true. And everything at that time, now looking back, has an element of unreality about it, or and I remember the first night I spent, I just listened to, I stayed up, all day and all night, and I just listened to songs that we sung together. I listened to all the recordings we'd made together, and then when we could finally get together properly and talk about things, we just didn't know what to do. Also, you've got to remember as well that all our gigs had been, as every other band, there were gigs booked through COVID that never happened, so they were all rescheduled. So what we first decided to do was at least honor those commitments and go out and do these gigs as a way, as a send-off for Kush, and also as a way for the audience to get together, because people hadn't even been able to get together to grieve, And the first few gigs were, I mean, it was almost impossible to play. Everyone was, the audience were crying and we were crying, and there was lots of hugs going around. You've got to remember as well, people hadn't been able to touch each other even. So the whole thing was super charged emotionally. We just
Very
did know what
emotional.
to do. And I think, apart from lots of people say, please keep going, please keep going, you're like a, by this point, we are like a family. I think it was a gig that we did in London where Kush's sons came up on stage and joined us for a song. And then afterwards, we all had a chat, and they were saying, keep going, because it's a way of keeping our dad alive, keeping his memory alive. Not that it would fade anyway, but that's how I see it. I mean, Paul, is your view the
Yeah,
truth?
I can only concur with what you said. I remember playing up in Edinburgh on that sort of tour where we agreed that each night would be a kind of requiem, on that very first tour, and every night was an incredibly heightened feeling of emotions. And so I don't think I could ever do another tour quite like that. So it was definitely it took an awful lot.
I think it was the first gig that we did without Kirsch. We had to go up to, we did a gig at the Robin too in Bilston, and it was an all-day festival indoors. And what happened is our equipment had been set up, but no one at that end had heard that Kush had passed. And so all his stuff was set up. There was a microphone for him, the amp was set up, and everything. And so we went on, and there's this massive gap between me and Ricky, Kush would have been, and it was just dreadful. But as a result of that, what we do now is we bring Kush's amp and Kush's guitar to every gig we do, and we set it up on, it's there on the stage as if he decided to come and walk on that stage and he could pick it up and play it, but
I remember sh just shaking every night before going on, just my hands shaking, everything shaking, just that kind of suppressed kind of feeling of, that feeling that it was almost impossible to do. But we forced ourselves, really, thanks to the audience in many ways, that we managed to do it.
Look, I know it was a tragedy and is a tragedy, but I'm glad you're doing it, and I'm glad you're for his memory. It's a beautiful thing.
Yeah, that's how we feel as well, that it's for his memory. And Kush is always with us in a way. I'm always talking about him in the van. We joke about it, and he's such an integral, part. It's like we decided we'd never replace him. It's not, there's no way that someone could be. And there was quite a few people offered, and we thought we can't have a, there's no point having like a Kush impersonator join the band, So we just, we adapted, and we are the way we are.
So I wanted to ask you about Bobby Valentino. I mean, fantastic fiddle player on loads of your songs. Did you ever consider him making an, I know he's a session musician, but do you ever consider making him an official member of the band?
He is really. I mean, we're out on tour now. He's with us every show. Well, actually, saying that, we had a couple of shows up in Lancashire just 2 weeks ago, and Bobby forgot. He forgot the shows. He just didn't turn up. But
We were waiting for him at the service station.
he has just turned 70. So it's fair enough. But he kind of is in the band. That was how we managed to. One of the things we did in order to go forward from Kirsch was extend Bobby's role in the band, and that's worked out brilliantly, really. He's, as you say, he's the best in the business, really.
We're lucky to have him, and he's just not on the board where me and Paul are.
Yeah, no, he's the talent.
What's the reaction been to the anniversary gigs so far? Has it been pretty good?
Amazing.
No, well, they've all been outstanding, and we've been, really enthused by the crowd. We've played at places where we expected it to be not so full, and it has been full. We always think, well, there's going to be a bad one. It's bound to be, but yeah, it's just been outstanding.
So last question then is one we ask everybody that comes on the podcast, and that's you. What's your greatest memory that you've had up to this point?
With the band.
I think
Well,
for me, I think it was that Rock Summer, it was called. We played in Estonia on that. It was like their equivalent of, like, it was the same size as Live Aid. It went out live all across Russia, Estonia, some of the Scandinavian countries, and it was just so huge, the crowd. But also, I like the fact that the cameras, the TV cameras, were like something from the 1950s in the UK. They were like, the technology was so old school. But yeah, it's the nearest one to a gig where, and I don't think I was the only one, but for a split second thought, I cannot walk on stage. I can't do it. I can't do it. And then you just take that step and you're on, and it's all fine. That's mine.
I mean, I'm going to be cheeky and give you two, to be honest, the runner-up and the winner.
That's fine.
And so the runner-up would probably be when we supported David Bowie at Milton Keynes Bowl at the request of David Bowie's son, that we'd be on. And having been a very big Bowie fan when I was younger, much younger, it was a tremendous thrill, to be stood on the side of the stage with Bowie's set list taped to the stage in front of me and performing, just before him. Slightly made more remarkable by the fact that Kush decided to play the Laughing Gnome at that gig, which had been expressly forbidden by Bowie's management, and we got into some considerable trouble because he did that. But bless him, it was one of the most rock and roll things that I've ever seen anyone ever do in my life, and that was one of the great memories of Kush as well as the band. But my number one would be probably we were lucky enough to do a tour of Egypt via the British Council, and one of the shows was up on the Med Coast up by Alexandria, and we played the gardens of this amazing palace, and the gardens curved down to the sea, and it was just a pure joy to be there just visually. I don't remember what the gig was like, probably not very good, but just the experience of being there in this bizarre, very weird situation has always stayed with me as a sort of major memory.
Paul and Swill, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you
Thank
very
you
much.
for inviting us.
It's been enjoyable.
Thanks,
Brilliant.
guys.
7 weeks it rained from June until July. In August, wheel it out for the equator. I sold my red guitar, Joey sold a little car. We crossed the channel hidden in a freighter. We hit the lift of Leon in an open mini moke. A drunken driver took us to Marseille. I could say bonjour, Joey knew the law. The rest we memorized along the way. Everything we'd said, everything we'd done, every check we'd saved, every hand we'd won, we put it.
Well, thank you for listening to this episode of the Uncharted 80s podcast. As you know, we do our research from a variety of sources. You want to add any more details to what we've talked about, then you can, of course, contact us. Where can they contact us, Noel?
Well, they can contact us on our email address, which is podcast@uncharted80s.com.
Brilliant. Or you can do that via our Facebook group, the Uncharted 80s. Thanks, everybody, for listening.
Thank you.